VCT Audio, the art of good listening. You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it. Boris Dobson was a flamboyant, openly gay man, a war veteran and boxer. He and his partner Fred Halliday moved to a sleepy village in the backwaters of Barnsley called Darfield, where they ran the local corner shop until their retirement. Not a particularly remarkable story, you would think, except this tale is set in the 1950s, where communities were insular and intolerant, and of course homosexuality was illegal. Morris would wear makeup and wear exotic suits. Any intolerance that was meted out to Morris was dealt with by his expert fists, something the police were glad of. Whether it was his ability to look after himself, or an outward confidence to be whatever he wanted to be, people started to respect Morris. Described as Darfield's an old coward, he died in the late 90s, and he left the shop to the Amenities Society. Through hard work and perhaps a love for Morris, the shop became a museum to him and the village he lived in. So join us now as we visit the Morris Dobson Museum and Heritage Centre, where we speak to the volunteers and look at the life of one Morris Dobson.
Yes, Geoffrey Hutchinson, I was past chairman of the museum, but well and truly retired now, 6 years ago.
Well, Jeff, I suppose the story of the Darfield Museum really started with you. Just tell me about how the museum came about.
Back in 73, we set up the Amenity Society for the village, which was a voluntary society that tried to just do the ordinary things that a parish council might do in a village. We always wanted a museum, and Morris knew this. Morris owned this place, and he left a will that said that he wanted his house to be used for the village. More or less left it at that. And so when he died, it was left to the Amenity Society, and we were told, well, you're going to get on with it. It was in a poor state. There was everything wrong with it that could be. We took it on. Amid some opposition within our society, I can well remember the meeting when it came that we had to sign for it. Fortunately, it was over the 50% that said, yes, we'll have a go. Very, very fortunately, within a short time, Heritage Lottery came on the scene. And so, in our naivety, we said, well, we'll just apply to them. They'll give us the money. And then that restores it. I duly got the forms and filled them in. And then they came back and said, no. So two of us from the society once more went down to London and banged on the table, the Heritage Lottery headquarters, and said, come on, Darfield needs this. You've got this set up. It's people's money. They said to us, you must employ a proper conservation architect. We'd got John down the road to draw up some plans.
Was he an architect?
Oh, he said he was an engineer. But he'd got a lot of tall stories. And, you know, we came back from London and I rang up an architect in York called Linda Lockett. She said, well, I'll come down and have a look. She came down. We explained what we wanted. We showed her the plans that we'd got. And we signed an agreement with her that if we got a grant, we'd pay her. And if we didn't get a grant, hard luck. She drew up all the plans to restore this place. And once more, we submitted these to Heritage Lottery. They came up, did the trustees from London to come and look at us. And I think they'd got great doubts. They gave us £164,000. And with that, and other money that we'd raised ourselves, we got together all the amount of money that was needed, which was getting on for £200,000. Linda appointed the builders, and she supervised it all.
How much work was required to get the building into some sort of fit state?
A lot. There was dry rot. There was wet rot. The outside had been covered in concrete render that was hiding all the subsidence cracks. Of course, it needed rewiring. Of course, it needed replumbing. The paintwork had to be heritage accepted. We were left with an empty building that was admired. Yeah, it looks great. Dalfield's a very old village, as you know. And we'd been saving things over the years. When we saw things being thrown away, we put them into cardboard boxes and they went into the back of my garage. We ran an estate car in those days, didn't we, a Victor? And into the estate car they went, and down here they came. We used any odd scraps of wood to make shelving with no display cases. And so, having got it, you know, with some things on display, we opened the doors. Gradually, then, over the years, we got display cases, mainly second-hand, but good second-hand. Once more, we were still applying for grants, and so we ran special days. Members of the society would be down here with the do-it-yourself drills, with the screwdrivers, all the rest. So there's all the shelving that you might see around. It's proved quite a success in a lot of ways. The museum appeals to a lot of people for its quirkiness.
What do you think is the appeal?
I mean, it starts with Morris, doesn't it, and Fred. At the time that Morris and Fred were living here together and entertaining the police, police would come in for a quiet drink. At the same time that they lived together and homosexuality was against the law, there was a chap or two chaps in Cudworth being prosecuted in the courts. Fred was a gentle chap. Morris, people remember him because he'd got a biting tongue in a lot of ways. The girls, when they would come down from dancing school, would come in maybe for some sweets. Give us a twirl. Sort of.
You must be very proud to see the way the museum has moved on and how it is today.
Yeah, yes, we are. I mean, Elsie became treasurer and I became, well, I was chairman all the way through up until I reached 80, 6 years ago. And now we can either close it down and do something else with the building or else it can continue. And the result was, it continued, I am very pleased to say. And it's still run, of course, by volunteers, as it's always been. The whole thing depends on, as so many things, depends on volunteers.
Hello, my name's Ken Brooks, and I'm a tour guide at the Morris Dobson Museum.
So, how did you become involved with the museum?
Well, in early 2000s, I was a member of the Amenities Society and I retired in 2007. And that's when I started volunteering at the museum, when I'd got plenty of time.
Well, before we talk about the museum, perhaps, because you actually met Morris Dobson, didn't you?
Well, Morris, he were a little bit keen. He wouldn't allow us to sit on the windowsill. He'd chase us off on a Saturday morning when we'd been to the local cinema, which is across the road, and we'd call in the shop here for an ice cream on our way home. And Morris, he cared, but he were keen. He were a bit short-tempered at times.
Morris was unusual, I suppose, for his time, in that he was a gay man when homosexuality was illegal. But he dealt with that quite well with people around him, didn't he?
Well, I talk about this quite a bit. And in 1956, when Morris came here to live, I was 14. And we didn't have education, sex education, like they do today. And I'm not certain that we knew about homosexuality. And so we thought Morris and Fred were here as friends running the shop. There were one or two village idiots at the time and that shout abuse through the shop window, and but Morris would go outside and deal with it himself. He didn't have to send for the police. Morris, he could handle himself. He'd been in the force for 17 years and he was a good boxer, so he didn't mess with Morris. He wasn't very big, but he packed a punch.
He wasn't ashamed of his own sexuality, was he? I mean, looking at some of the photographs, it was quite obviously he wore makeup in the day and quite flamboyant suits.
I remember him in a pale blue suit. His photographs, yes, he wore makeup. Externally, that's in the village, that's as far as it went, makeup. He were a good ballroom dancer. The ladies loved him because he'd be at the one wool baths dancing. Yes, he were that type of a chap.
I'm told they had a parrot.
Yes, he had a parrot sat on his shoulder, and it would swear at you. Well, I don't swear, so... But the parrot did. It would tell you where to go.
Now, we're in the front room of the museum, I suppose, and you said this is basically the heart of the museum, so...
Well, it's the oldest residential property in Darfield, built in 1750. A Georgian property, built on a site where there were farmers' houses. Post and truss construction, and every piece of timber in this building has been recycled from the houses that were here before.
So we've got loads of things in this museum. We're going to have a wander around in a moment. Just tell us about some of the things that are in the room.
This room, when we opened in 2000, Morris's artifacts were brought back, what we can afford to insure, and they are all in this room, what belonged to Morris. So there's his long case clock. It's a marriage, inasmuch as the clock were made in 1750 in Rotherham, and the case is 100 years later, a Victorian case. Morris only bought what he liked. He didn't know what he was buying. This is a Jacobean chair made in 1670, 1680. The floor in this cottage is a little uneven, and so Morris cut that leg down. Now, anybody that knew what he were buying wouldn't cut the leg off a Jacobean chair. Most of his ceramics are in Cannon Hall, but we've just got this rack here with some Rockingham pottery on it. Very rare pieces these now, as Rockingham closed many years ago.
Yeah. He was a keen collector of things, wasn't he?
He bought and sold. He didn't know what he were buying and selling, but that's what he did to boost his funds, of course. There weren't pensions like there is today. When Morris retired in 1977, we've got his snuff box here, a ram's horn.
That is quite flamboyant, that, isn't it?
Our snuff box, that came back exactly as we sent it. He were a romancer, Morris. He liked to make things look a little bit better than what they actually were. The chap in the red jacket there is cut from a magazine. And he's put it in a frame.
Put it in a nice frame, yes. Well, shall we have a look at some of the other stuff that's in the museum?
This is the memorabilia room. Every piece in here has been brought in by Darfield people. In 2000, it was completely empty. And we've collected all this ever since.
Well, there's all sorts in here, isn't there?
We have a curiosity cabinet, which I'll tell you about one or two of the curious pieces that we have.
Now, that looks like a square truncheon to me.
This is what an optician would use in Victorian times for testing train drivers' eyes. When they told me what it was, I didn't believe them either. So I went to York Railway Museum, and they've got two. And then we have Dr. McCora's blood circulator.
It looks like a hand drill.
Made in 1908. It just vibrates. And you can see that it would circulate the blood, a small massage. But Dr. McCora claimed that it would cure anything. Asthma, bronchitis, deafness, hemorrhoids.
If only that were true.
Unfortunately, Dr. McCora in 1912 were jailed for 3 years for selling a useless piece of medical equipment.
Now, that looks like a big whistle to me.
This is for putting tips on snooker cues. So you put your cue in here, tighten it. This is a file. You would file the top, push it to the top, and attach the tip. Still used today, but not as good as this.
Right, that looks like another implement used for hitting people, to be honest.
This is a cosh. This is a Victorian policeman's weapon. and it's called a life preserver.
Not for the person that's getting it on the head.
The only life that's been preserved is the man that's holding it.
That looks a nasty piece of equipment, that.
Certainly is. Yeah. Made of solid hardwood. That would kill somebody.
You got lots of, just looking on top of the cabinet, you got lots of various styles of hats, top hats and boaters and cookware and lots of electrical equipment as well, which some of them I remember as a child, barely.
A portable record player, a record maker. You could record off the radio or you could off a microphone.
That's it. I didn't think these existed back then.
Yes, these are late 40s, and they record onto a magnetic disc. And this is where the term cutter disc comes from.
Ah, right.
That's what cuts the disc. Then when you wanted to record something else, you could clean it.
Right.
So you just hold that on.
Oh, right, so it was reusable.
Reusable, yeah. Very good.
That's very clever, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Considering the time that it, was it 1953?
53 to 59.
I've learnt something today.
And then, of course, from his bedroom window here, a beautiful view of the Norman Tower at the local parish church, a Grade 1 listed building.
Yeah. Well, it's an old village, isn't it? When does the church date back to?
The church foundations are 1050. The Norman Tower, of course, is after 1086. But there's been a church on that site from 700.
So this is his, what would have been his bedroom?
First bedroom,
yeah.
And Darfield, of course, is an agricultural area. Always was and still is a big agricultural area. Its name means deer in the meadow. In 1086, when William the Conqueror's men arrived here, that's all they found were meadow and deer, and called it Derrifelt.
Right, I see.
And that's got anglicised to Darfield.
Yes. So let's have a look at the other bedroom. Now this is a bigger room than I expected, to be honest.
This is a nice size room. This, and this tells us the recent history of Darfield. We coal mining, of course, came here. Darfield Main in 1861, Houghton Main in 1875, and of course, with coal mining, we always remember the disasters.
Mm.
This was the first one, the Lundill disaster. 189 men and boys were killed at this one. 146 of these men and boys are buried here in Darfield churchyard under this obelisk. And then we move on then to the Overwind disaster at Houghton Main, 1886. When the cage came up too far, the rope broke and the cage went back to the bottom with 10 men on. This was father and two sons, father and son. Again, these 10, they're buried in Darfield churchyard.
I mean, that's a tragedy of these things, isn't it? That, you know, miners, it's a generational thing. And in one accident, you could literally wipe out two generations in one go.
Yeah. And then this is the last one that we had in 1975, the explosion at Houghton Main. And this is the policeman's notebook.
I would say I recognise that notebook.
Who were first on site.
Yeah.
PC Steve Wyers. Now, I know PC Steve Wyers, and he knows I'm interested in the museum, and he asked me if I'd like the notebook.
Yes.
Well, I said, would I? And so there it is on display.
Well, I mean, I started my police career with a notebook, and that's exactly, I recognise that immediately, even the way it's filled out. It's exactly the same.
He were there first at 10 o'clock at the evening, and he worked until 6 o'clock the following day. He did 20 hours, and he claimed 26 pence for a cup of tea. And this is the piece de resistance in our museum.
Well, I was going to say, Ken, when I got into the room, my eye caught that immediately, and it looks like a couple of bits of driftwood, but it's probably a bit more than that.
This is the first water pump from 1520, called a rag and chain pump. And we have a model here that shows what it would do. It was a rag attached to a chain, called a rag and chain pump. When you start digging down and the coal outcropped here in Darfield, So in 1520, there weren't deep mines. They took the coal from the surface. But when you start digging, you get water in the sump. So they had to get rid of the water. There'd be two men at the top here winding. The rag would soak up the water and deposit it at the surface.
Yes.
Moving on, here we have the football factory.
That's not a football I'd like to kick.
All the best footballs made here in Darfield. Cup final, first division and on, all made in Darfield. The FA would ring up to Darfield, to Mr. Miller, the manager, and say, we'd like you to stitch the cup final ball. Well, Mr. Miller was the manager, so one of the girls would stitch it and put his name inside, because your name's inside the tongue there. Who made it for quality control, and to make seven a day to make a living, so they knew who'd made them. This opened in 1947 for jobs for ladies they were looking for. It was just after the Second World War, and the men hadn't come back from the war. And so it was jobs for ladies. He employed about 100 at the time. And it closed in 1984. Mitre Sports were the company, and they're stitched exactly the same way today.
Well, I suppose all this wouldn't have been possible without Maurice Dobson.
Well, he did leave his property to the community, but Geoffrey Hutchinson and his wife Elsie, they put a lot of work into this,
yeah,
raising funds.
What do you think draws people to the museum? I mean, it's very busy today. I'm sure the bacon balms that are being served have nothing to do with it, but it is. It's a very busy place and a very popular place, it seems to me.
Well, there are regulars that come in on a Saturday morning. If you want to know anything that's happened in the village during the week, call in for a cup of tea on a Saturday morning. But we do get new people in. We've had a few new people in this morning that we've escorted round the museum and told them exactly what we've told you.
Hello, my name's Ian McPhee. I'm a retired railwayman and a retired town planner. And I live in Nottingham, and I come up to the Darfield Museum, the Maurice Dobson Museum, once a month, and meet up with friends, old and new, and soak in what is a unique and relaxed atmosphere here in the museum, mainly in the cafe, as far as I'm, as far as my business is concerned.
That's quite a heavy commitment from yourself, isn't it, having to travel from Nottingham? So how did you kind of get involved with the museum?
It was mainly through Ian McMillan, who, as I'm sure many people will know, is a very outgoing personality and a very, very kind one as well. He told me about this place and what happens here when I saw him doing his performances with either Tony Husband or with Luke Carver-Goss. It sounded a very interesting place. I was especially interested in coming. I have a great interest in what many people might regard as mundane. So the daily doings of people, the daily lives, that's the part of social history that really interests me.
It's an area that's seen a lot of social change, hasn't it, as a result of the mining industry collapsing and the sense of community and the impact that it had on that. And I was talking with Ken before. You're right about the community. It's more than a museum, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's what it is for me. It's a beautiful reflection of the character of the people of the area. Everybody knows the rather troubling aspects of the miners' strikes in 1974 and 1984. To some extent, that still has, if you like, a scar on the on the local area. But they are extraordinarily resilient and stoical round here. And I love the idea that they've just picked themselves up. This museum is a wonderful tribute to that stoicism, I think. They've produced something here which is, it's a microcosm of working life. Not necessarily just working class life. And I would commend anybody to come and see it, because it's just a jewel of a place, I think.
Well, let's not forget that the museum is about Maurice Dobson mainly, and you talk about resilience, and certainly his life was one of resilience, wasn't it?
Well, it was, yes. He's the sort of bloke, sadly, from the generation before mine, he's the sort of bloke you hear about him and you think, oh, I wish I could have met that fella. What a fascinating person he must have been. The tales I've been told about him, about the sweary parrot and the rather outwardly gay appearance that he had and so on, and he couldn't care less, really, what people thought about him. And he just seems to have been great fun. It's the sort of chap where you think, I wish he'd lived in our village.
And it's a rare commodity, isn't it, that people have the courage to be themselves, where we live in a day and age where the internet and social media and TikTok, Instagram, where, you know, people want you to see them, but then they don't want you to see them. They don't want you to see the real them and the real life they're living, where Maurice was what you saw was what you got.
Indeed. And I think that it's also worth remembering that in those days, I mean, we're talking about the time when homosexuality was still illegal. We're talking about two people in Maurice and Fred who worked down the pit, and they'd worked in various other parts of British industry and so on. And actually, despite the makeup and the powder puff and so on, they were as hard as nails. Every now and then you'd get youths coming to have a drink and so on and cause trouble. And they took those two on at their peril.
Of course, Maurice was previously in the British Army and he was a champion boxer.
Indeed. It's easy. I think in those days that there was a far more stereotyping than there is now. Thankfully, that sort of thing is on the wane. But Maurice, he took no nonsense from anybody.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that in this modern era now, well-being groups, men's talking groups, it's all about connection. It's nothing new, is it?
I think that groups, perhaps laid on through charities and other social organisations, they've tried to take the place of the common or garden corner shop or independent business and so on, because we still recognise that we need to talk to each other, we need to understand each other, and we need to take on board the other person's point of view. You know, that's what civilised discourse is all about. It's what civilisation is all about.
As a volunteer, as you say, you come here once a month. What are the sort of things that you get up to whilst you're at the museum?
In the truest sense of the word, I'm not a volunteer as such. I like to contribute to the fundraising things that take place, the events that take place here. I'll always support those. And I like to think that my consumption of refreshments and comestibles in the museum cafe keeps the place afloat.
I think you're his main benefactor, aren't you?
Very much so, as my ever burgeoning and groaning waistline will testify.
But it is a lovely place, isn't it? And it's a lovely place because there's lovely people here.
The people here are just extraordinarily decent, and it is something for me to look forward to in a world which seems to be at times spiralling into chaos. This is it's like a little slice of, I wouldn't say paradise, but it's a place of peace and tranquility and happiness and kindness. And the people who come here to volunteer, they are very, very generous of their time and of their spirit. The world is a better place for that.
Well, I'm with Ian McMillan, star of Radio 3, The Verb. And when he's not doing that, presenting his show or travelling up and down the country and doing workshops and stage appearances, he puts on a pinny and volunteers at the Darfield Museum in the cafe. What kind of brought you to the museum? How did you get involved with it, Ian?
I'd always been coming into the museum as a punter, particularly when my grandkids were little. It was part of our routine on a Saturday morning. I had my grandson, Thomas, who's now 18, and we go to the library, and we go to the park, and we go to the museum. And it never kind of occurred to me that you could volunteer here. I thought, wrongly, that it was a group of people who did it all. And then I saw this sign that said, volunteers needed. And I said to Jeff Hutchinson, I said, so I think I might volunteer here, Jeff. He went, here's your penny. I said, well, maybe not just now, Jeff, I've got to get back. And he said, right, off you go. And so I started from there. My wife said, well, she'll volunteer as well. And it made you realise, actually, how vital the volunteers are to this place and to any place like this. So every second Saturday, me and my wife come along and wash up and make cakes and sell cakes. But what I like doing best when I volunteer is actually being part of the social aspect of this place, because a lot of people will come here and just sit and have a chat, and it's become a kind of community hub in that way, and that's what I love about it. People do come for tours. We've had people today come for a tour, and most times we're open, people come for a tour, but I think what I like best is the way that people come here and find it a safe space, and we'll sit and chat and stay all day. And it's fulfilling a vital role in this community. It always makes me think you could replicate this anywhere. I know that Ken and Jeff have talked about the special circumstances of this place, and that's true. You know, we have the building, we have the story of Morris, but I think anywhere could have a museum. There could be a temporary pop-up museum. It could be a museum in an older house. It could be part of the library. But if you have a museum that's attached to a cafe, that would become a real community hub. So whenever people come here, I always want them to go away and have the idea that this could be something they could do. That's my idea.
Well, it's interesting you say that, and certainly the other volunteers I've spoken to, it's quite clear to me that it is more than a museum. I will leave today remembering the museum, but I think I'll be remembering the people more.
It is. It's about companionship. I know that people come here sometimes who can be a bit lonely, and who will just enjoy coming to the museum for the crack and just for the talking and the laughter and the feeling that here I am in a safe space where nobody judges me. No, not even the past judges me. Sometimes when I go to a museum, I feel kind of judged by history. History going, you haven't worked hard enough, Macmillan, come on. But here, you think, oh, I can just do it. And I think somehow the spirit of Morris, his mischievous kind of trickster spirit, is over this place. Because, you know, I remember Morris as when I was a lad, I would come in here after church lads brigade and he would serve me in the shop, and it felt very ordinary that him and Fred were a couple. That was the great thing about it, you know, and he was a bit rough and ready. He used to go, I love poetry. And I said, oh, I like Ted Hughes, I said to him. And he went, Ted Hughes, that modern stuff. Couldn't stand modern stuff. I says, but he's from Mexborough. He said, well, there you go, he says. There you go, how can he be any good? He's from Mexborough. He says, no, he says, poet's got to be dead, said Morris. He always thought that a dead poet, as soon as he was dead, he was fine. I said, and if I'd have said to him, Ted Hughes is dead, he said, what a great poet. You know, he had this idea that somehow, because he collected antiques, you know, the antique poet, the antique artist was the thing. That always interested me. And there was also this, they used to say, he's got a collection of militaria downstairs in cellar. And that's what they always used to say, he's got this collection of militaria. Which maybe he had, maybe he hadn't, but that became the idea of Morris the Collector. And I'm sure that's where the real seeds of this museum as an idea was sown, because the idea that Morris collected things and Morris kept things, and he thought, well, then we need to keep the story of Morris going, Morris and Fred. So in a sense, you know, whenever we're sitting around having a cup of tea in this place, I reckon, you know, the ghost of Morris is watching us, nodding with a kind of cynical approval. I think not cynical, that's the wrong word, but a kind of arch, as they call it, approval. You know, I think he's got one eyebrow lifted.
Do you think he'd be happy the way the museum has turned out?
I think he would. I mean, I think he always wanted, towards the end of his life, he wanted it to be a museum. And you wonder how far ahead you think. You know what I mean? None of us think that far ahead, but having been open over 20 years now, you wonder if he would have thought, well, I never thought it would last that long. I mean, you try and take the long view and think, well, when we've all gone, in another 50 years, this place might still be here, and I hope it is. But I think he'd be pleased at how it's gone. I think, being Morris, being the kind of fella he is, he might have liked his name in bigger letters. He might have liked some kind of neon lights, pink neon lights, Morris Dobson. Now, that would be an idea. I've just thought of that, you know. And that would be a great idea, Morris Dobson in big lights.
I don't think Darfield Council would very much appreciate it looking like something like a strip club or something.
You'd have to call it a club called something like Dobson's. Clubs in small towns.
Dobson's Wine Bar.
Dobson's Wine Bar. You see, I had this idea a while ago. We got a few local breweries around here. They could have a Morris Dobson ale. I still think that's an idea. I don't think Morris was a big beer drinker, but I think you could have Morris Dobson ale. And you sometimes think, years ago, Jeff Hutchinson had this idea that we should wear branded pinnies that said, you know, Morris Dobson, and maybe, you know, have a Morris Dobson badge. So I think there's more to be done with the brand, if you like, of Maurice Dobson. I know a lot of the committee members have talked about the LGBTQ plus audience that's out there that we maybe don't shout about enough to, and maybe the idea of a brand for Maurice would be great. We had some postcards done, which I may have told you about before, where just this great postcard with a picture of Maurice, and it said, "Maurice says relax," like Frankie says relax. You know, we could push Maurice more, as it were. Whether he'd want to be pushed, I don't know, but I think we could certainly push Maurice more.
Do you have any anecdotes about Maurice that you could share with us?
Well, Maurice was that amazing thing. Him and his partner Fred were that very unusual thing in a pit village in the 50s, an out gay couple who were out and proud. Mm. And what a fantastic thing that is. And because they've both been in military, if anybody come in, if some pitmen come in and said out to him, Maurice just gave him a crack.
Yeah, he was quite an accomplished boxer, wasn't he?
And they had a swearing parrot that used to swear at you. But Maurice would sit there in like a powder blue suit on a high stool with a cigarette in a holder, looking like Noel Coward.
Yes.
And he would. Oh, I love poetry. It was quite camp. I love poetry. Yeah. And that story for me is a story of tolerance and a story of acceptance and a story of these two men can thrive in this village that, you know, people would say was, you know, old-fashioned. But the parrot, mugger off, he used to say. And there was all these fantastic stories about what happened to parrot. So one story was that Fred, the quieter of the couple, finally went mad and actually wrung the parrot's neck. Another story was that Fred and Maurice put it in back of a car, drove it off and released it up in Moors. Another story was, which I think is my favourite, they took it to Chester Zoo in a bag and left it on the steps of Chester Zoo. But then a few years ago, we had an actor who did a one-man show about Maurice, and as a kind of promenade show, yeah, where people would come in and he'd greet them at the shop as Maurice and take them round. Yeah. And we asked some of the older people of Darfield, I said, "Did you enjoy that?" And they said, "Well, we were pretty good," he said. This fella said, "But Maurice weren't that tall." I said, "Well, he was an actor." But yes, it is. And I think you could dig anywhere and find these stories. That's what I like about this museum. You know, it's full of Darfield stories.
He sounds like a man that was more than history remembers him to be. Sometimes people's personas are elevated, aren't they, after death? But I get the impression with Maurice that, no, he was everything that you think he was and more besides.
He was. There's that cliche about somebody being larger than life. And I think Maurice really was larger than life. You had to be in a place like this to live the life he led. As we always say, to be an out gay man with his out gay partner in a rough oil like this. You know, and so he had to be larger than life. He had to be theatrical. You know, the shop front was his stage. You know, sat on his high stool with his powder blue suit and his cigarette in a holder. That was him holding forth. That was his stage. You know, and he was almost, in some ways, you know, a fictional character. He'd invented, perhaps, in a way, the character of Maurice, the camp entertainer, as it were, because that was his way of projecting himself in technicolour onto this black and white place that South Yorkshire was in the 50s and 60s, you know. And so, I think he was. He truly was. I would love it if, by some kind of theatrical or physics trickery, we could have this time machine where we brought Maurice back and show him what we'd done. And I think we would be revealed that he was larger than life. That was the only way he was large, because I remember he'd be quite short and all. I think that's why he sat on a high stool, because he was quite short. So he was a short man who was larger than life.
That's a good way to describe him, isn't it? And everybody I've spoken to, they've all said is that it's a man you would have want to have met, which is a great epitaph, isn't it?
He wasn't always a genial guy. You know, he was a bit spiky, but that's part of it. And you would want to have met him. Yes, you would. You would. And he's left his mark on this place, literally, with his name being here, but also kind of metaphorically, with, as we often talk about, he's been a story of acceptance and love, most definitely.
It is clear that the Darfield Museum is much more than just a building housing local memorabilia and antiques. It has become a living, breathing oasis of community, a place of worship almost, where people come to share stories over a cup of tea and a bacon cob, where connection and compassion is in abundance. Something I'm sure Maurice would approve of. Perhaps the greatest epitaph one can attribute to Maurice Dobson is that he is a man you would have loved to have met.